Marin. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking, sobbing conservatives. Man, it's rough days for you, isn't it? Trying to lie your way out of this bag of crap that you've gotten yourselves into. Good luck with that. Good morning to all you rich liberals who think that civil rights is how you treat your nanny. We took her to our doctor. Good morning to you. Look, you know, Riley, it's nice to see you.
What's up, man?
Dude, I got to be honest with you, man. I was going to go to the gym yesterday, and I went to into a cooking frenzy. It was ridiculous. You know, the girls
here. What did you cook?
Oh, dude, it was nuts. I went, oh,
wait
buddy.
A minute, what is this about the girls here?
What's the girls, oh, yeah. Jamie and Andy. Yeah, yeah. The publicists have been bothering me. I had to bring it up that I make a cake, that I make a chocolate cake, a double-layer chocolate cake. Occasionally, I make it. I haven't made one since I've been here in New York. Went out and bought the pans. Went out and bought some Scharfenberger chocolate. Scharfenberger, I guess it's a German chocolate, or at least a German name. It's the best chocolate in the world. I'm telling you, man, I'm making this thing from scratch. There's powdered cocoa, you know, kind of floating in the air. I'm getting like a buzz. I'm getting like a little cocoa buzz while I'm making this.
So you made the women a cake, is that right?
I made a big old cake, and I made some red chilies from New Mexico, and I made myself dinner. I had some miso monkfish from the fellas at Marino's and Sons Fish.
Uh-oh.
That's on 30th Avenue in Astoria, New York. Marino and Sons Fish. Okay, you guys, I'm just, if you're sitting there, you're putting the ice out, thank you very much for everything you're doing for me. I appreciate the monkfish. Now, that's what I've been. I also want to thank Penelope in Wyoming again, because I got to tell you, Penelope is one of our biggest fans, and
yeah.
Not only is she a supportive, a wonderful fan, she sends us presents, and she sent us this big old boxes of Christmas holiday presents. She made ceramic bowls for all of us
yes.
that are glazed with our names on it, or nicknames. I got a Future Mark bowl. Pashman got Son of Lewis and Linda Pashman bowl. Riley, would you get a Pops Riley?
I got
Riley?
Pops Riley.
And she glazed these bowls and sent us spoons and
yes.
cereal and $5 to get milk. And don't think we didn't do it. What, Dan?
I actually had a dream about it last night, Mark.
Oh, Lord.
I know that this this won't come as a surprise to you, but I often dream about food.
Yes.
And I actually had a dream that that a fifth box came the next day, that Penelope has actually sent us an extra box with more cereal in it. And it came the next day, and like there were like 6 more boxes of cereal, and man, did we chow down.
I'm not sure if that's sad or what, but now I think that was a secret hint. Yeah, but I think Penelope is...
No, Penelope's been so kind. Let our other listeners take a lesson from Penelope.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You send us boxes of cereal, too, listeners.
Zabar's gift certificates, H&H bagels. We'll take beer, non-alcoholic beer
from Mark
Maron.
Didn't Penelope send us
a gift certificate of Zabar's.
She's amazing. I don't know what she does up there. She sent us monogrammed frames. She sent Mort Mortensen, a
handkerchiefs. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. Look, I want to read this email because I thought it was a very not. I don't know if what's prescient mean. What does that mean?
Prescient.
Prescient.
You know, I had a time prophetic.
Yeah.
No, this is not. It's not prescient. It's kind of precious. How about that? It's a PR thing. Listen to this. Good morning, Mark Maron. Your feelings of your use of the German expression Schadenfreude, which someone had to point out to us, I think, is pronounced Schadenfreude. Yeah. Duh. There's a little duh at the end. Scharfenberger chocolates, very good. The best. It's in the cake I'm going to eat later. Schadenfreude should not be considered taking pleasure in the Republican corporate plutocrats' misfortunes, but are more simply explained as your sophisticated appreciation of poetic justice.
Okay.
I thought that was very nice. He said, I'm misusing Schadenfreude because that would implicate me as somehow being, you know, not the greatest person in the world necessarily, but just by appreciating the poetic justice of these bastards going down is a perfectly decent human feeling to have. Not just poetic justice, but perhaps real justice, because we're coming up to the end of the grand jury's term, and Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald is apparently not expected to take any action in the case this week. This means he's finishing up, I hope, and it doesn't seem like he's going to issue a final report, which it would have been a possibility if he were not going to indict anyone. He has signaled that he has no plans to issue the grand jury's findings in that kind of detail yet. He's got two options, I guess, Riley, if I'm understanding this properly, to close the investigation with no public disclosure of his findings or to indict.
Yes.
Is that it?
That's pretty much it. And believe me, taking option A would create a huge political firestorm, given what everyone knows thus far. It would be like, What do you mean no indictments?
Right. What do you mean no indictments would come from the Democrats? And then there'd be
might come from some Republicans too.
Right. Exactly. At this point, they'd want a full disclosure of what's happening. According to some lawyers in the case, Fitzgerald's trying to figure out how to proceed. Apparently, he's sitting on thousands of pages of testimony. He's trying to figure out what the indictments are or whether there's going to be criminal charges. I'm telling you, if there are not criminal charges at this point, I will be so insanely disappointed. I might have to make another cake. It isn't clear at this point whether he has identified the source of the initial leak of Valerie Plame's name, but fingers are pointing at Dick Cheney. The White House is trying to figure out just exactly what it's going to do if Rove is indicted. Who's going to get that gig? Now, obviously, no one's got his brain, which I wish would go dead. But, the guys in the running are Dan Bartlett, who is Bush's private counselor, personal counselor, Ken Melman, the chair of the RNC, who I couldn't imagine doing that job, Robert M. Kimmett, the Treasury Secretary. But obviously, Rove will have some, whether he's in jail or not, I got a feeling that this guy is going to be, running things, detached or not detached. Doesn't matter.
Look, the names you just ran, Mark, in sports parlance, AAA ball players.
Yeah.
These are not the pros.
No, Ken Melman, come on, dude.
No. Rove is on that level irreplaceable for George W. Bush. Andy Card, by the way, who is Bush's chief of staff, knows good, and he doesn't even like Rove that much, but he knows that Rove is irreplaceable on that level, and Card is not going to try and do his job.
Yeah. Now, here's a little story I like to call Cheney and the Snitch. It's going to be a children's book. There are speculations being made that Dick Cheney may go down because of what Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury has found out. There's all indications that he will. There's rumors right now that he might resign. Now, if he does go down, it would be most likely guilty of conspiracy, which means he gave the go-ahead to leak Valerie Plame's name, thus revealing her identity as an undercover operative for the CIA. He did it to spite her husband and to shut him up for dismantling one of the foundations of the big lie that the neocon death cult invasion of Iraq was based on. We talked yesterday about the possibility of there being an insider singing for the Fitzgerald grand jury. Well, there is, and it is assumed to be John Hanna, who I guess was Cheney's point man on the Middle East. He was a senior national security aide. He was on loan to Vice President Cheney from the office of John Bolton. That's right, the guy who visited Valerie Plame, which Riley brought up yesterday.
No, he visited Judith Miller.
Judith Miller, sorry. Yeah. Visited Judith Miller in jail, and is now, of course, he's screaming U.S. ambassador to the UN. Now, when Hanna worked for him, he was an undersecretary for arms control. Hanna was told he could face indictment as a co-conspirator if he didn't cut a deal, so it appears like he did. Now, let's talk about that for a minute. So he used to work, this is John Hanna, the guy who's supposedly giving information, inside information to the grand jury, singing. I don't want to call him a snitch, which he is, but he's
No. Let me tell you something. This guy has a very long and very tawdry history. You know where he goes back to?
You remember
the Pentagon Office of Special Plans?
Yeah.
That existed from September of 02 until June of 03.
Right.
He was part of that.
Right.
Okay. He was that office's liaison to Dick Cheney before he started working
for
Dick
Cheney. So the Special Plans Office, is that where the intelligence information was coming in from Iraq?
That's right.
He filtered all that Chalabi garbage
that was
at the basis of many of Judith Miller's pieces?
Yes. And this is all part of that whole little run-up to the war in Iraq. He apparently was a major player in this.
Yeah, well, it seems that he was in charge. He and Scooter Libby in Cheney's office were in charge of filtering information and intelligence coming out of Iraq from Ahmed Chalabi, who proved to be just if not a complete Republican stooge, certainly somebody of an incredibly shady background. He's wanted for embezzlement, isn't he, in Jordan?
Yeah, he is.
And he's wanted, and also it turns out that a lot of the intelligence he was manufacturing was to suit his own political means, and that was the intelligence that they were basing their invasion of Iraq on, much of it. And much of it was some of the intelligence that Judith Miller was basing many of her articles on that all turned out to be crap. So this guy, Hanna, John Hanna is now the guy who is singing to the grand jury, and he's probably got some real dirt.
And think about this for a minute. He worked for John Bolton, all right? Who was in a better position to know what Valerie Plame Wilson was doing than John Bolton, who was working the same side of the street, nuclear non-proliferation. That was her deep cover job.
Yeah.
You don't think he knew?
Yeah, it's amazing what the implications of that are, Riley, because this in this conspiracy could really go pretty far. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much he's going to be able to really nail, but we've got a list. Robert Johnson has got a, he's been on our show before. Larry Johnson, Robert Johnson, the blues player, who was on our show in spirit because yes. We summoned him up through the Ouija board, and that happens sometimes if you're at the crossroads. You can just talk to Robert Johnson. But look, Larry Johnson, who is a counterterrorism, he's an ex, he's a CIA agent, a
yes.
CIA operative.
And ex-State Department.
An ex-State Department guy. He's been on our show a lot. On his blog, he tips some stuff. We'll share that with you in a minute. I'd like to go into with Riley. Riley dug up some stuff this morning about what the crime really is. Because there is some spin going on behalf of the right from the orifices and sphincters of Fox News and the mouths of Republican pundits. The talking points are that this is criminal. Politicizing.
Criminalizing
politics,
yes.
Which is ridiculous. The idea that like, hey, you guys, this is just politics is normal is ridiculous because there is a crime committed, and not just a crime, but something that could look like and is most likely treason if this were a real government, in the sense that people were actually, accused of that and punished for that. And the punishment for treason is death. And we will share with you, what that is, what that criminal allegation looks like in all its nuance. After this, it's 17 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Mornings Edition.
MorningsEdition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningsEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Twenty two past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Fair America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning. It's Wednesday morning. It's difficult. Strap in, Florida. It looks like Wilma is, up towards a Category 5.
Whoa.
It's pounding Mexico. It's pounding Central America. I hope it doesn't get you guys, but it's been a tough year for you, but it might be coming in, so do what you got to do. Also, we got the iNews in a few minutes. Also, Cameron Crowe, we're going to get on the phone in a little while. Also, what we were talking about before was that Dick Cheney may be going down because of John Hanna, a guy who was working in his office as his Middle East point man on loan from John Bolton. This guy is apparently singing to the grand jury because he probably got to said, you're going to go to jail. He is dirty, my friend. He is under investigation by U.S. authorities for his involvement with an intelligence program run by the Iraqi National Congress and its leader, Ahmed Shalabi. Remember him. He is dirty, too, and responsible for facilitating some of the information that Judith Miller uses as source material in her propaganda for the neocon death cult's weapon of mass destruction propaganda. A campaign. Speaking of weapons of mass destruction, kinda, because this is all kind of about that, the Valerie Plame leak, which we're going to get into a little deeper in a second. According to Larry Johnson, who's a friend of the show here, who was an ex-State Department guy, an ex-CIA guy, apparently he had lunch with a person who has direct ties to someone facing indictment in the Plame case. There are 22 files that Prosecutor Fitzgerald is looking at for potential indictment. They include individuals, Stephen Hadley, Karl Rove, Louis Libby, Dick Cheney, and Mary Madeline. Hadley has told friends that he expects to be indicted. Now, this is from Larry Johnson's blog, and he's an inside guy. He knows what he's talking about. We haven't really talked much about Mary Madeline, but,
no.
Looks like she's in trouble, too. I wonder what that conversation is with James Carville at home. You might be going to jail, baby.
Who's going to watch the kids? Well, hey, I mean, this is some deep, deep, deep dirt.
Well, let's talk about this because you brought this up this morning, Riley, and you dug it up on there on the internet there with your computer thingy. Now, let's talk about what outing Valerie Plame means and what the difference is between the outing of Valerie Wilson, the wife of Joe Wilson, and the outing of Valerie Plame, a CIA operative who uses that name as her undercover name.
Okay. As Valerie Plame, she was affiliated with a CIA front company, not working a desk as an analyst. She was working a deep cover operation with a company called Brewster Jennings and Associates. Why is that significant? Because once all of the foreign intelligence services
yep.
saw the name Valerie Plame, They're going to, not Valerie Wilson, Valerie Plame. They will connect that name to whatever operations Brewster Jennings and Associates had in their countries, and then they begin doing background on her from there and to figure out exactly what she was doing. That's the danger, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is espionage.
And that also, you know, on the evil side of that, is like, don't think that if Brewster's doing that, that the other people, the other side, people who are enemies of this country are doing that, are looking what she's connected with. This compromised national security on a tremendous scale. The way this sort of spreads, the malignancy of a leak like this, could compromise national security globally, which they did voluntarily as a means to get back at a political opponent, a center. Now, let's talk about what's going on television. Through many dirty media orifices, the right's talking points on this leak case is, quote, the criminalization of politics, end quote. In other words, they are basically saying that outing an undercover agent and compromising national security in a time of war with an act of treason, it was an act of treason and an anti-American act, is just politics. That's basically what they're saying. Of course, I, you know, translated it through my head that, you know, they are willing to say, and they are willing to put the, if you buy this, folks, you are truly lost and you are un-American in your beliefs. There are laws for a reason. If these guys were acting in the name of national security, why would they have compromised the cover of a CIA agent on the weapons of mass destruction beat to punish someone who disagreed with them and prove them wrong? Because they don't care about national security. They are guilty of treason. They will not be prosecuted for that. But they, you know, whoever leaked this initially, Dick Cheney should be executed for treason.
Well, I'll tell you what. Patrick Fitzgerald, maybe, and I'm saying maybe because right now it is not completely confirmed, but Patrick Fitzgerald may be digging so deep in this. You know when you see those things where people operate and they get right down to the bone?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Patrick Fitzgerald has apparently, according to one published report I'm looking at right now, been trying to figure out who forged the original documents about the yellow cake uranium from Niger.
Yeah,
think about this for me.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, how's he? Wow, that's getting down to the bone.
That's getting down to the bone because he apparently has gotten some records from Italy, which is where that report first came from, that might implicate a couple of American CIA people, ex-CIA people, in the actual forgery.
Who else would have done that?
Think about it.
And of course, according to a database search, every television reference to the CIA leak case as criminalization of politics in the last 30 days, of course, came out of the mouths of anchors on Fox News.
Well, yeah.
It's 27 past the hour. We're going to do the iNews in just a minute. So hang out. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
All right, folks, it's 34 past the hour. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
In just a couple minutes, we're going to talk about what rich people think of poor people. And I'm not just talking about regular, really rich people, just middle-class people, their attitudes towards poor people. Because, you know, a lot of times middle-class people are just poor people with better credit in a nicer neighborhood. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, I have an iNews Wi-Fi translator 5000 thingy machine. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. Oh, boy. My brain is skidding today. Just skidding. It's detaching itself from my cortex or whatever the thing is at the root of it, the stem. Yeah. Questionnaire. Questionnaire shows Myers opposed most abortions. I guess that's the end of that bit.
Thanks for coming by.
Maybe I should move the machine a little closer to me. I'm reaching. That's weird how that happened. I think that was Brendan, actually, the spirit of Brendan McDonald. That would imply that maybe he's not with us, but he is. He's just on his honeymoon, so he's not with us here, but he's still.
By the way, are any of us taking bets on how long the wedding's going to last?
Or the wedding?
The marriage?
Oh.
That guy?
You
and that
cynic.
Girl? What, are you crazy? He's going to stay married forever.
You think so? Forever?
Absolutely.
Hey, yo, that's Ozzy and Harriet, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. That guy, those people are not divorcing people. Not screwed up like you. All right. Questionnaire. Can we get on with the bit? Questionnaire shows Myers opposed most abortions. Myers. Questionnaire shows Myers opposed most abortions. reported advocate of poor wants more poor babies. From New York Times, another Hurricane Wilma threatens Florida. Sorry. Another Hurricane Wilma threatens Florida. Wilma threatens Florida. State expects yabba dabba devastation. No, that's horrible. Here's another one. Jeb Bush's invisible warrior friend fails again. From Associated Press, scientist studies gorilla who uses tool. Translation, worried military finds new supply of recruits. So that's it? Where did Kalo go? He just walked out? Trent, your name's Trent, right? All right, Trent, so he just left. I said once. Now he's got this weird device that he does, this passive-aggressive thing where I make a little, I jab him a little bit and just leaves.
Into aggressive-aggressive. So.
Yeah. What? Yeah.
Turning into aggressive-aggressive.
No, it's not, because he just left.
Exactly.
He just walks out and leaves the new bearded guy there, who's new to the whole thing. And
Speaking of which, where did Trent's tie go?
Well, I was just going to ask.
He looks so nice yesterday.
Well, apparently it's casual
Somebody
Wednesday.
Somebody must have got the job. That's why I'm here today.
It's casual Wednesday. You didn't get the job? That's why you're still here? Where'd you apply for that job?
That's classified information.
He's not playing. He's not playing. I don't know. I don't know if Trent's cool yet.
Uh-oh.
We're going to have to work that out.
Casual Monday, I guess.
Casual Monday? Wasn't it casual Friday? Where are we at? Hey, look at this. Saddam's on TV right now. It's been 2 years since Saddam Hussein was caught in a hole outside Tikrit. Now he's facing charges for killing thousands of people one way or another on several different occasions. Saddam's lawyer said Tuesday, and that's going on right now. Today, he's going to ask for a 3-month adjournment at the trial that's going on this morning for a 1982 massacre, and he challenged the court's competence to hear the case. First off, I think it's a long shot that Saddam will get off on a technicality. Second, what about the other massacres? Do those trials still go forward? What's happening now is that he's sitting there in front of this judge saying, this does not matter. You are not the real court. I am the president. That was a close one. Where's my throne?
Well, yeah, and he has rejected this court's power to try him because he is, of course, the president of Iraq. Now, what's interesting about this is they're caught between a rock and a hard place. If they find him guilty and sentence him to death, they have to execute him within 30 days, which means he doesn't go to trial on the other charges unless they get a waiver.
So he's pulling the standard kind of genocidal tyrant defense here. You're not a real court.
Yeah.
I am the leader. Get out of my country. I will kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tropical Storm Wilma officially became a Category 5 hurricane with winds up to 175 miles an hour. In all seriousness, it could hit Florida over the weekend. So, Mom, do what you got to do. Get out if you can. Put something on the windows. And everyone in Florida, get ready. It's been a rough year for you. This is the 12th hurricane of the season, which means it will tie the record for the most hurricanes to form in the Atlantic in history. Now, let's get to this poll. It's a very interesting poll. Those at the poverty level were almost twice as likely to say factors beyond their control are responsible for their impoverished state. Okay, and those who make higher incomes were evenly split on whether poverty is caused by external factors or by people not making an effort. Yeah, this is an interesting frame, Riley, because for some reason, people in the middle class, and certainly people in the upper class, but even some people in the really upper class are more, understanding about the cause of poverty. But it's interesting how many people believe that most poverty is caused by people's laziness or that they don't do what they need to do to get jobs. And this is assuming there are jobs to get. And of course, that those people aren't completely compromised, because of generations of, abuse and the weight of economic disability upon them.
Well, what you see here, Mark, I think is it's symptomatic of a larger issue, and that is in this capitalist economy and capitalist culture, there is the unspoken notion that anybody who makes money is inherently better than people that don't.
Or that they work.
Yeah, or that they work for it, or that they earned it, or that they, they got it based on merit. All of that is implied. People don't run around saying, I'm better than you because I make more. That would be, gauche, I guess. But if you look deep into the culture, you realize that that is there virtually at every turn.
Yeah.
And what, what the people with money essentially say to the poor is, get yours because I got mine.
And there is no entry. That is the issue that people rarely talk about in terms of class, in the way that networks work, in the way that corporations work, in the way that business communities work, is that there has to be, someone has to allow you in for whatever reason. And whatever reasons those are, whether they're, it's education, a friend in the firm, rarely is it because somebody is completely willing to work. If they come from another class of people, that person is going to have to jump through a lot more hoops to get someplace that somebody like Dan Pashman could just walk into because he's a bright guy and has a good education and his father is a lawyer.
You're right. But what's interesting is America, perhaps unique among developed countries, has created and has had people create other avenues, whether it's hip-hop culture or sports or whatever, where people can come from absolutely impoverished backgrounds and end up making a whole lot of money. Now, what happens to it is a whole different story.
Well, that's entrepreneurial spirit. And
yes,
certainly that does happen, and that is something that this country
is... But it's rare.
It's something that this country is based on. Yeah. It is something that people aspire to, but not everybody's going to do that. Not everybody has the wherewithal or the fortitude or the courage or the go-get-it kind of attitude or the creativity to make that happen. Those are rare people. Those are special people.
Absolutely.
Now, what we are seeing is that because of the way the economy is structured now, a lot of jobs have left the manufacturing to other countries, and even now with something like the rebuilding of New Orleans after Katrina, you have a president who is making it almost impossible for working poor people who are citizens of this country who are ready to do the work, who are ready to help rebuild their own city. He's making it virtually impossible for them to make a good living doing that.
Well, yeah, and see, this is the great unspoken thing. What ends up happening is those manufacturing jobs are gone. What do those workers end up having to do? They end up having to work two jobs, probably both without health insurance, to make ends meet. And, you know, how long do you think people can work, like 16, 18-hour days before their bodies run out? And, of course, they got no health care.
And they take it out, and the aggravation builds up. It strains the family structure.
Absolutely.
Even in terms of the military, a lot of the people in the military come from this type of working-class poor people. And, like, that strains the family. There's drugs. You know who said it best, really, in terms of – it's interesting because – but poor people in general in this poll remain optimistic
about their children's futures anyway.
And also about that something will turn. There's something religious about the idea that they may be feeling persecuted by forces that are beyond their control, yet they do still have faith. Whereas I think that in the middle class, you see a lot more competitive spirit and this sort of like, screw them before they screw me. I'm going to get what I want. And Christopher Hedges spoke to this a little bit when we were at Maxwell's, a week and a half ago. Christopher Hedges, of course, author of a War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Losing Moses on the Highway, the Ten Commandments in America. One of our favorite guests. Can we hear that sound from Chris?
When there's no work anymore, everything unravels. Families unravel. Personal lives unravel. Addictions take over. There's a complete loss of control. And that disenfranchisement of tens of millions of Americans and the decision by our country to turn our backs on them, including, of course, the Democratic Party, is what has created this movement. And until we begin to address the despair that has distorted these lives to unfathomable degrees, I do these interviews and my heart breaks. You'd have to have a heart of stone not to listen to this stuff. And you understand that's clinging to this ideology, this notion that suddenly they've become part of the elect, that Jesus cares for them, that they will be empowered in the end, is all they have left. And I look at that as, and that's not their fault, that's our fault.
It's interesting. He was talking about doing research for a book that he's writing about the theocratic movement here in this country. He might even title it American Fascism, in terms of, exploiting Christianity in order to run this country with a moral, with using the Bible as a book of law. But, it is interesting that what keeps being pointed out, Riley, is that, and we talked about it yesterday, is that Democrats, that the poor as a group, And there are obviously class issues in this country that aren't spoken about. And Katrina brought a lot of that to light. But, you know, even now, that's starting to recede in terms of the public discourse about poverty. And this was a primary tenet of Democratic politics, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And you just do not hear Democrats, you don't hear anybody talking about what can practically be done about the horrendous poverty that exists in this country.
Well, you know, if you ask the average 10 people in this country, what is poverty? How much does the poor person make? You're going to get 10 different answers.
Under $15,000.
Well, you have government numbers, but then you have real world numbers depending on where people live. $15,000 in the city of New York without a subsidy means you got to move someplace because you can't live here. You simply cannot live here.
And there's just no plan to deal with this. And because the jobs are leaving, and now, you know, their ability to represent themselves in courts of law in terms of bankruptcy or in terms of being victimized by jobs, in terms of malpractice, are all being limited. You know, the scary thing is that we talk about it a lot, is I really think that because of God, that the right and the rich are feeling that this is a replenishable resource, poor people as consumers, and that they don't care if they die. They don't care where those people are going to go after Katrina. They don't care if they ever make it back to that city. And once they leave the state, it's no longer their problem. And I don't hear Democrats addressing this either. You know, we're getting caught up with stupid moral issues that we're letting the right dictate, and we're not addressing some of the core values that were once important to our party's message.
Well, you know what? One of the things that people have to realize about American politics is that if you go back and look at it from the beginning, they built it based in large measure on distrust of the poor. If you look at the way legislatures are set up, if you look at the Electoral College, all of this is a way of putting some distance between the rabble and direct election of their representation.
Yeah, and now that, you know, some of it seems so fixed, it just, I don't know when there's going to be an effective, charismatic spokesperson with a real plan for how to handle poverty in this country. And I'll tell you, it's not going to come from New York, looking at how so many of the wealthier Democrats and even just regular Democrats are starting to back Bloomberg.
Some of them that hate his guts are backing him. Yeah, that's the amazing part.
You're going to have to explain some of that to me. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Also, there's a new study that was done at the University of Southern California into the brain that really explains politicians. If you're curious about that, stay here. It's 47 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
It's 52 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
In a couple seconds, we're going to have the Cliff Notes. We're also going to talk about Democrats rushing to feed off of the Bloomberg energy field right now. But according to a study out of USC, pathological liars may have structural abnormalities in their brains. Finally, a clinical explanation for politicians and salespeople.
Yeah, right.
Researchers have found that individuals who are constantly lying and cheating have less gray matter and more white matter in their prefrontal cortex than regular people. Man, that sounds like a bunch of lies to me.
Yeah.
No, but let's talk about that for a minute, because I'm going to sit here and I'm reading something I read and I'm explaining it to you, but I have not explained to you what is the difference between gray matter and white matter. Well, the prefrontal cortex apparently shows a heightened activity when normal people lie. It is believed to be involved in the prefrontal cortex is believed to be a part of learning moral behavior and feeling remorse. The study says what it says, because gray matter is made up of brain cells, white matter is made up of connections between the cells. Thus, pathological liars have more capacity to lie and fewer moral restraints. Now, I don't know how they figure this stuff out in determining the difference between white matter and gray matter, but apparently if you got too much white matter, you got a lot of connecting stuff, but you don't have the dense gray matter to help you make decisions that are moral and right and lie. But I'll tell you, I don't know how this will fly as a defense, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, baby, I couldn't help myself. I got mental problems. That's why I swept with your friend. Yeah. I told her I have mental problems, but that seemed to turn her on, so I had to do it. But you know what? I didn't like it. And I'm being honest about that. I didn't like it at all, baby. Yeah.
My brain may be abnormal, but
how's that gonna hold
up? I can show a little remorse.
How's that going to hold up? It's not going to happen.
No.
Look, all right, so let's talk about this. Democratic politicians are lining up behind Michael Bloomberg. Riley, who are they? What does it mean? If you don't want to name names, you don't have to, because I know we are a national show. But is it obviously over for Freddie Ferrer here in New York, or no?
I don't know that it's over for Freddie Ferrer. What he's done has been to attach himself, ironically enough, to a group of national figures. Word is, former President Bill Clinton's going to be on the street with him tomorrow.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. Yeah, they're doing it. He's trying to do a national thing to counteract the fact that Democrats, local Democrats, are hemorrhaging
yeah.
away from Freddie Ferrer and going to Michael Bloomberg, including some of his toughest critics. For example, one elected official who constantly fought with him about education, endorsed him yesterday. Another city council member, gay city council member, who called him a hypocrite for his stand on gay rights, endorsed him the other day. You have another black council member from Queens who opposed him tooth and nail on the West Side Stadium plan, the plan to build a stadium for the New York Jets football team. He endorsed him last weekend.
Yeah.
So all of these people that have big problems with the mayor, all of these Democrats with big problems with the mayor, are endorsing him. Now, here's the problem.
Yeah.
Back in the day, you did that at your peril because you had county organizations that would make your life a living hell.
Yeah.
If you cross party lines to endorse, for example, in New York or Republican, that would be considered complete and utter political suicide. Not anymore. Partly because the county organizations are not as strong as they used to be, and partly because term limits have made these folks in the council, particularly local elected officials, so ambitious to get another gig when their 8 years is up, they don't care who they cross anymore.
Well, that's interesting, Riley, because it seems that's the way it goes in all of politics. And I didn't know this before I took this job and started really investigating the nuances of this, is that most of the time, most politicians are out for their own good. They are opportunists.
Yeah.
They are looking to fool their constituents into believing whatever line they're pitching to them in order to get what they want. Obviously, there is a quid pro quo there, I guess it would be, where they have to give something to the constituents or make it seem like they're getting something, or the community or the state. But this is the way it goes. So many of these people are relatively disingenuous panderers who are just trying to stay in the game.
Now, should we tie these two stories together, the white matter and the abnormal brain and some of these politicians?
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, the ability to be a good politician is, on a lot of levels, the people that win the vote are the ones that are rewarded for lying the best, because most of what comes out of their mouth is crap. It's lies, and it's completely disingenuous. They are duplicitous people. They are certainly pathological people. In my life, I've witnessed very few politicians who were earnest or actually did what they said they were going to do in any way.
Oh, well, yeah, well, that's true. You see Mike Bloomberg calling this one council member a grandstander on education, and now he's saying that they share a passion for the city schools, and I'm proud she's joining my team.
Wow.
Which part of the matter managed to get them to say that?
Yeah, that was that would be the white matter.
Yeah, I think so.
What's up, Dan?
Well, I was going to say, I think a lot of it has to do with building a wall in your brain in terms of lying and these brain abnormalities. And I think a lot of these politicians have an ability to build a wall in their brain and convince themselves that they are telling the truth, a la Tom DeLay saying, hey, I didn't do it.
Right, but I'll tell you, just because you are physically incapable of these type of things, of not lying or moral thinking, you can learn how to behave properly, even though it's not your instinct. I know that to be true. It's 57 past the hour. It's Air America Radio. We'll be back with Cliff Notes. It's Morning Sedition. That's right. It's 6 past the hour. Good morning. It's Wednesday, people. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Glad to have you on board, friends. Hey, if you're in the Bay Area, I'll be at the Usher Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California, this Saturday night at 8 p.m. For tickets, you can go to marinjcc.org. I'll be there working out my problems in an entertaining way for strangers. Always interesting. That's what I'll... you know what? How can I plug my own show by saying that? Like it's a blurb. Always interesting. Newsweek. draining Time magazine. Anyways, here we go. It should be fun. For those of you who are just tuning in, by the way, we're going to be talking to director Cameron Crowe in a few minutes. For those of you who are just tuning in on the phone, if we can get him on the phone, we'll get him right then. Absolutely. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. Walmart gave a contribution to embattled former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay even after his recent indictment on money laundering and conspiracy charges. Walmart gave DeLay money right after he got indicted because they knew that's when they'd get him at a bargain price. Walmart execs defended the move, saying that even if DeLay is convicted, they can resell their investment in him later at Sam's Club as damaged goods. A new study suggests that pathological liars may have abnormalities in their brains. Unfortunately, the study was largely based on interviews with pathological liars. Interestingly, the study also concluded that pathological liars have much better jobs, lots more money, and that a surprising number are, quote, really good friends with Jim Carrey. Pathological liars may have a predisposition to lie and should be differentiated from pathological lawyers who undergo years of training to lie. A new climate study says that because of global warming, the U.S. will face more extreme temperatures and more severe rainfall over the next century. Vice President Dick Cheney called this prediction nonsense and moved further underground. Experts warn that rising temperatures in conjunction with an epidemic of obesity means future generations will see a lot more fat people in bathing suits. So, you know, I don't know. That's either good or bad. Depends where you stand on the fat people in bathing suits thing. You know, that's some people like that. All right, look, I'm sorry, Florida. I had nothing to do with it, but Tropical Storm Wilma officially got strong enough to become a hurricane, dangerous category 5. Category 5 hurricane with winds up to 175 miles an hour. Wilma is now currently raining on Central America and Mexico. There is a significant threat to Florida over the weekend, so do what you got to do. Take care of yourselves. Strap yourselves in. You know, board up your windows. I don't know what needs to be done, but I am sorry because it has been tough. This is the 12th hurricane of the season, and that means this hurricane season is tied for the most number of hurricanes that formed in the Atlantic in the history of hurricanes that we know of. It is the 21st hurricane. Is it really? It's the 21st? It's the 21st hurricane? It's not the 12th hurricane this season? Okay, I'm sorry. I had the number screwed up. Maybe I'm dyslexic. Yeah.
21st ties a record, doesn't it?
I just said that, yeah. Apparently the other information I said was right. It was just a little number problem I had, the 21st. I don't want to misinform people any more than my ideological bias does. But there's certainly nothing I can't be biased about hurricanes, although there's a rumor that Karl Rove has a weather machine that he changes the weather. Anyways, it's been 2 years since Saddam Hussein was caught in a hole outside Tikrit. He's now facing charges for killing thousands of people one way or the other on several different occasions. The trial is going on now. He is now asking for a three-month adjournment at his trial for a 1982 massacre. He challenged the court's competence to hear the case. He's now saying, this is not the real court. You're not the people who are in charge. I am the king, and you must, please. Where is my stick?
Well, you know, this stems from an incident where somebody tried to kill him.
Yeah.
And he took out 150 people from this village and executed them, predominantly Shiite village, by the way.
Yeah.
Apparently... some of the higher-ups in the current Iraqi government were looking for him for that for quite some time. They had family in that particular village.
Yeah, and this is like, you know, as you said before, Riley, if he gets nailed on this, he could be killed before he even goes to trial for the genocide
yes.
that he engaged in with the Kurds. Yes,
180,000.
You know, and that's heavy, man. And it's interesting to me that he is taking the Milosevic defense, which is I'm president, and I don't know who you people are. Let's do this. Harriet Myers, who herself is an abortion of a nomination for Supreme Court Justice, supported a constitutional amendment banning abortions except when necessary to save the life of the mother back in 1989. She was a candidate for Dallas City Council. She also showed overall support for Texans United for Life and showed up at rallies in the early days. And we knew this. This was information we had. I guess her views were made clear in a questionnaire that the White House submitted to the Judiciary Committee. And now, look, of course, some Republicans like John Cornyn of Texas are saying, hey, it doesn't matter what her personal views are because, you know, as a Supreme Court justice, she will not pursue a personal or political agenda from the bench. Ha! Why should we believe that? Why should we even think that she knows how to be a judge? Democrats are calling foul because of the views, and I'm sure that they don't think a Supreme Court justice will bring personal beliefs onto the bench either. But with Myers, it's all we really have, isn't it, Riley? That's all we got. There's no history here. And don't bring up Rehnquist.
No. Let me tell you something. More importantly, it's all Bush has. See, he's the one. It's the Bush people that are coming out and dropping this. Well, she has some demonstrable pro-life chops. Because without this, the Brownbecks of the world and some of the other more conservative members of the Senate are not going to back the woman.
So you're saying that, you know, 2 days ago we were talking about Newt Gingrich reframing talking points and de-evangelicizing her for the public's consumption, and now they're re-evangelicizing her to, you know, pander to Sam Brownback. The real concern here is going to be Sam Brownback, who is a Republican who is sitting on the Judiciary Committee, and if they lose his vote, she's going down. So they're just doing this for Sam Brownback?
Well, they're not evangelicalizing her. What they're doing, though, is saying that these are positions she took when she was on the Dallas and running for the Dallas City Council. They're tying it into politics, not necessarily into her religious beliefs. But what's scary about this is every time they try to do this, every time they try to send a signal to their base that she's going to do, the quote, the right thing on abortion, the Democrats rightly jump up and say, well, wait a minute, you're implying that she's already made up her mind about this issue. That's what they did when they tried to tie James Dobson to, you know, well, she told me something, I can't tell you what it is, but she's okay. Every time they try to push on this pro-life situation, the Democrats have to push back and say, wait a minute, she's already made up her mind.
Well, the thing is, I personally don't see how you separate this issue from the religious right in this country. So in my head, you know, there are ways that they are trying to present her as somebody who's smart, somebody who has legal experience. And then on another level, they're still trying to, you know, pander to the religious right in terms of them justifying this candidate and feeling okay with it. Because I think they are. I think this is all about Sam Brownback. It's got to be.
Well, it's about Brownback, and it's about other influential members of the Judiciary Committee and of the full Senate. Now, they're being real optimistic at this point, thinking that they're going to get her past the Judiciary Committee and onto the floor. But, you know, let's be optimistic about it.
Yeah.
They've still got a lot of people to convince. The Trent Lotts of the world and some of these other folks are still not on the Harriet Myers bus. Not yet.
Yeah, I think she's going down, but I don't know what that means. I don't know what comes in if she goes down. We're coming up to the end of the grand jury's term, and Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald Fischel is not expected to take any action in the case this week. He is finishing up, I assume. I don't think, apparently many don't think, that he's going to issue a final report. That would only be a possibility if he wasn't going to indict anyone. He has signaled that he has no plans to issue the grand jury's findings in that kind of detail yet, so we're still on board that he is going to indict a lot of people. Man, you know, we've been speculating like crazy here, you know, off the mic, that this could be conspiracy, could even be espionage. You know, there are some indications that this investigation is reaching all the way to Italy to get documents on the forged documents about the Nigerian yellowcake uranium. And if he has got that kind of reach, I mean, he's sitting on thousands of pages of testimony. We don't even know, you know, how broad this thing is.
He needs to watch his back if he's going that close to the bone,
yeah.
I gotta tell you.
Well, you know, Larry Johnson, a friend of the show, ex-State Department guy, ex-CIA guy, had some interesting stuff to say. We'll get to that in just a second. It's 15 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey,
you know, we're talking a little bit about, of course, the plane leak case. We're talking about how you know, this thing can get big, it can get wide. It could be espionage, it could be treason, it could be conspiracy. Who knows who's going to be involved? There's talk out there that Dick Cheney may go down. There's talk he might resign. You know, in a couple minutes, we're going to talk to Cameron Crowe on another level. We're also going to hear the war on brains just shortly. According to Larry Johnson, who's a friend of the show, ex-CIA guy, ex-State Department guy, apparently he had lunch with someone he knows who has direct ties to someone facing indictment in the plane case. And he says there are 22 files that Prosecutor Fitzgerald is looking at for potential indictment. They include Stephen Hadley, Karl Rove, Louis Libby, Dick Cheney, Mary Matlin. You know, Hadley apparently has told friends that he expects to be indicted. Let's not forget, as our friend Dale alerted us to, that, you know, Condoleezza Rice is up to her neck in this stuff as well.
Well, yeah, Stephen Hadley was working. He was Condoleezza Rice's number two when she was at the National Security Council.
Yep.
And now he's NSA, National Security Advisor.
And all these people are connected. John Bolton is connected to who is rumored to be an underling of John Bolton's is rumored to be the guy who is singing right now for the grand jury. We talked yesterday about the possibility there being an insider singing for the Fitzgerald grand jury. Well, there is, and it is assumed to be John Hanna, who was Cheney's point man on the Middle East. He was a senior national security aide. He was on loan to Vice President Cheney from John Bolton, who was championed by Condoleezza Rice.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, and John Bolton is the guy who visited Judith Miller in prison. Now I'm assuming that he was there to say, look, this is getting too thick. You might as well get yourself off the hook. I'm here to tell you that. And then Scooter Libby, who is Cheney's chief of staff, wrote her a letter saying roughly the same thing.
None of these people should be working for the U.S. government. And we're just really scratching the surface here, Mark. There's about, I would say, about 24 people that have been involved in this up to their necks. And I'm not just talking about the outing of Valerie Plame. I'm talking about producing the false documentation and intelligence that led us into a senseless and unnecessary war. And they're all walking around, and most of them are either working for six figures for this government, or they're working for six figures or seven figures in the private sector, and they all need to be walked through a perp walk and sent to prison once they are, of course, justly tried and convicted.
In cuffs. Now, you know what's interesting about what we were talking about before? Given that the neocon group was, you know, put together in the mid-90s or even some of them before in terms of ideology, and in 95 they were already talking about, you know, going into Iraq. So there's a real good chance that some of what Fitzgerald's investigating ideologically, maybe in practice, which makes it scary, was already in place before, you know, a few years before George W. Bush ever became president for whatever reason that happened.
Some of these people go back to the Reagan years. Some of these people go back to Iran-Contra. One of these people came up with the brilliant idea of mining the harbors in Managua, the capital of Nicaragua, which was roundly condemned by the rest of the world back in the mid-1980s.
Well, let's talk about the crime, okay? The crime is, you know, they talk about this act, you know, they talk about the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, all right? This is a law intended to prevent the disclosure of information by persons having or having had access to classified information that identifies a covert agent. The law is a response to the death of Richard Welch, the CIA station chief in Greece, who was murdered in 1970. After his identity was outed in a magazine called Counterspy that actively sought to expose covert agents. Three parts of the act. A, disclosure of information by persons having or having had access to classified information that identifies a covert agent. B, disclosure of information by persons who learn of covert agents as a result of having access to classified information. And C, disclosure of information by persons in course of pattern of activities intended to identify and expose covert agents. A person can be charged for any one of the three parts. The best case scenario for those involved in this investigation, conviction of only a single count of perjury or obstruction of justice, either of which carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. There's very rarely that federal prosecutors do one count indictments. But more importantly, what Riley and I were talking about before the show was what it really means. You know, what does it really mean? You know, outside of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, all right, what we're talking about here could possibly be just straight out espionage and straight out treason. And a lot of this hinges on the difference between the name Valerie Wilson and Valerie, I have trouble with L's, Valerie Plame.
Yeah. No, you know, this guy, Justin Raimondo, who heads antiwar.com, has been doing the heavy lifting on a lot of this stuff. And ironically enough, he's a conservative guy.
Yeah.
But he is saying essentially that Joe Wilson has alleged that the smear campaign against him did not begin in June when Judith Miller spoke to Scooter Libby. It began in March of 2003, which is when apparently he alleges there was a workup ordered by either Dick Cheney and or Scooter Libby. A workup is when they find out all the fast facts about you and your family.
Right,
okay?
Sure.
Now, this was at a point where Joe Wilson had written a report critical of the yellow cake situation, but had also seen the president in January of 2003 use that yellow cake allegation in his State of the Union address. So you can imagine Joe Wilson might have been pretty pissed off at that point because he had gone to Niger. He knew they were fake. There were other people in government and in the intelligence community that knew it was fake. According to Justin Raimondo, all you had to do was Google it. So now you have a situation where Dick Cheney is saying, wait, or Scooter Libby or whoever in the vice president's office is saying, wait a minute, how are we going to deal with this guy? And in March of 2003, allegedly, they decided to deal with him by smearing him. That's where you get to Valerie Plame, not Wilson, but Plame.
Which was her name. Her covert name, her name in the undercover intelligence community. And the publication of her maiden name blew the cover of a CIA front and imperiled anyone she might have come in contact with during her stint overseas on the weapons of mass destruction beat. So in other words, these guys were acting in the name of national security. So they said, why would they have compromised the cover of a CIA agent on the weapons of mass destruction beat to punish someone who disagreed with them and proved them wrong? Because they don't care about national security, and because of that, this is an act of treason and espionage. Because of that, it was intentional, and it compromised the entire national security by spreading this name out there.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And it might have been to keep people from digging deeper into exactly who forged those documents that ended up trying to verify that Iraq had tried to buy yellow cake from Niger.
And, of course, the right is saying this is a criminalization of politics. They're saying, hey, look, the Cheney, they were just doing what they do with politics. If that's what you think, you're an American, anti-American even. 27 past the hour, Cameron Crowe coming up next. Stay with us, Fair America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Lock the gates!
34 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Momentarily... going to get Cameron Crowe on the phone. Also, we got the War on Brains coming up with Mort Milfington.
Yeah.
Our next guest won an Oscar for Best Screenplay for the film Almost Famous and has directed other audience favorites such as Say Anything and Jerry Maguire. His new film Elizabethtown is open now. Please welcome to Morning's Edition Cameron Crowe. Good morning, my old friend.
Good morning, my friend.
Good morning.
That's Mark Riley, my co-host here. The one thing I noticed in looking at the credits of Elizabethtown is the absence of Mark Maron in this film.
And don't you know that the magic that drove us to the Oscar for Almost Famous is gone on this movie, and I think it's you. We need you.
Well,
it's not too late.
Yeah. Oh, it's not too late? You can get me in?
No, I think we should film something and slip it in. I know the movie's in the theaters, but it's not too late.
Oh, good. All right, because I was worried about that. I was concerned that, I know we were going to do Vanilla Sky, and that didn't pan out either, but... But I'll tell you, I do appreciate I know that the Almost Famous director's cut, which I watch and enjoy, is mostly about me, and I appreciate that.
You definitely tear it up in the director's cut. You and Noah Taylor, it is a brawl. We know that. And I just think we can't let Angry Promoter go. We need to bring him back.
I just remember, man, because, I shot that for 3 days with you, and then at night, you just kind of went away. You said, okay, the next crew will take care of this, and you left me alone with some other film crew to ride up and down that ramp for about 4 hours.
But then, when the time came, were we not there making it all happen? Yes, we were.
You were the greatest director I've ever worked with out of the two that I work with, and the other one I was in college, and he didn't know what he was doing. But
well,
I appreciate it.
I'll get together with him, and we'll have a Mark Festival and figure it all out for the future.
Let's talk about Elizabethtown, Cameron. I haven't seen it yet because the screenings are too late. I do morning radio, and unless you can come show it at my house... I don't know if I can see it until it actually gets into the theaters. Why don't you tell me what it's about?
Well, I love the sacrifice that you're talking about, Mark. I mean, that's the kind of commitment to the movie-going experience that really makes it all magic.
I got to go to bed at 8.
Yeah, if you can beam it into my bedroom window, I'll check out your movie. Because I really am excited about how you're following up our fine efforts on Almost Famous.
Oh, this is 2 movies ago already.
I know. the movie is about a a character played by Orlando Bloom that suffers huge emotional and actual fiasco at the beginning of the movie. Don't know if any of us can relate to that.
Oh, yeah.
This happens at the very beginning of the movie, and his journey really is to learn in a very comic and sometimes romantic way, you know, how to turn that kind of failure and transcend in life. And there's a lot of really great characters in it. It really takes people on a ride.
So it's a real ensemble comedy, kind of.
It is. It is. And Kirsten Dunst is in it, and Susan Sarandon, and Alec Baldwin just smokes. He has a part at the beginning of the movie and literally guillotines Orlando Bloom in a corporate but ugly, ugly way at the beginning of the movie. And it really, it's about, you know, love and loss and life and all the great stuff in between.
Now, are my notes right? Originally, you wanted Orlando Bloom for this. You ended up with Ashton Kutcher and then ended up with Orlando Bloom. Explain how that happened.
I started out, you know, Orlando wasn't available because he was doing one of his many epics set in another century.
Swashbucklers.
And I kind of knew him as a modern guy because we had worked together, and I really loved his quality, and he's great, you know. And he was busy for a while, so I went and I auditioned some other actors, and Ashton was one of them. And I think Ashton's really underrated for doing the kind of thing that we have in this movie, which is, you know, some drama, some comedy, and some romance. And it went from working really well to me figuring, you know what, the movie's set in the summer, I'm going to wait a little bit, do the movie in summer, Orlando will be available, and, you know, somewhere down the line we can do something with Ashton.
Again, I'm sorry I couldn't do it. I know that you'd called.
I waited years for you, Mark. I can wait a little bit more.
He was on the short list, though, right?
Pardon me?
He was on the short list.
Are you kidding me? He is the short list.
Oh, man. So now, this is the first time that how personal is this movie? I know that, you know, Almost Famous, obviously, was extremely personal. And yeah. This movie is also somewhat autobiographical, no?
It is. It's a little bit my dad's side of the family. Almost Famous really kind of got into a little bit of the effect my mom had on the family, or a mother can have on a family. And this movie is a little bit of a tribute to my dad. And now that I've run out of parents, it's time to go back to fictional stories for a while.
What do you mean? You still got your wife?
That's true. The Nancy Wilson story. There you go.
The Nancy Wilson.
Then we can go to the jazz singer Nancy Wilson story. And so there's avenues like crazy, you guys. This is good.
Nancy Wilson story. I tell you, my wife, Mishna, is such a huge Heart fan. She went and saw them on the last tour. She loves your wife.
That's cool.
She thinks she's so cool. I back to the movie.
I'll bring that up.
Yeah, sure.
The funny thing, though, is, you know, there's been personal stuff in all the movies I've been lucky enough to direct. It's funny, though, like the most embarrassing and personal stuff that you tend to put in, you know, the movie is tends to be the stuff that people come up to you later and say, I can't believe you put that in the movie. That's incredible. That felt like my life. And so, you know, I always kind of do a little bit of the personal stuff. Well, you know that.
Yeah, because it rings so true. You know, people know when you're speaking from the heart. You know, it makes a real organic feel to it.
It does. And sometimes if everything in a movie is kind of based on a fantasy or another movie, it gives you that feeling of like, okay, it's another movie, whatever.
Exactly.
But if you can go a little deeper sometimes, I think that's the stuff that you can remember later.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is film director Cameron Crowe. Cameron, you had a string of really, really successful movies, and then came Vanilla Sky, and it appears as though, at least in terms of some of the articles that I've read about Elizabethtown, that people are seemingly nervous about whether or not this is going to be a success for you. Are you as nervous as some of the people that write about you?
No, I mean, it's you've got to take the ride and just kind of write about what's right for you at the time. And Vanilla Sky was kind of a psychological journey inside the Tom Cruise character's head, and it really did polarize people. I think it's only now that everywhere we go, people kind of understand and want to talk about Vanilla Sky. It did really well in the theaters. It just surprised people, you know? And the thing about Elizabethtown is we showed it in an early form in Toronto, and you know, we got standing ovations in the public screening, and then some of the critics were like, you know, this feels like a movie that's very personal and probably is a little long. And my feeling was, it was, you know, and that was why it was a work in progress. So we took a few minutes out of it, which I was going to do anyway, and now I think the movie is completely ready. And some of the critics that saw it before are seeing it now going, yeah, so this is great. It's like it's done. And I'm like, yeah, it is. That's why I said it was a work in progress before.
So you actually took it to Toronto unfinished, so to speak.
Well, you know, 8 Mile, the Curtis Hanson movie, played in Toronto as a work in progress. And sometimes that's what happens. The deadline for the movie arrives, and you show the rougher cut. You know, it's sort of a tradition. But you know what? I love that it matters to people and that people pay attention like that, because it's really a gift when you can make a movie and a lot of people show up to see what it is, you know. So I'm really grateful for that.
And it's nice that you met them halfway and sort of heard what they had to say and answered some questions for yourself and actually altered the movie a little bit and came out with a better movie.
Well, the thing was, I already had the cut ready before we took it to the festival. It's just part of the process. I'll tell you what I learned the most about, and you guys know this about comedy for sure, is you learn from showing it to people. You learn from doing it for audiences, and more than, I mean, I learned from the good and the bad critically, but what I learned the most from is how it feels sitting in an audience. And you can just get a rhythm and feel how people are with you. And the great Billy Wilder, my favorite director of all time, I was lucky enough to write a book about.
It's a beautiful
him.
Book.
Thanks, man. And he said, the only way to know is how a movie is working is to watch it with an audience. And if your butt itches, you know it's time to make a cut. And you know what? He was a genius, and he's right.
Well, you know, I actually am excited to see the movie. We just found out you were going to be on the show yesterday. I'm certainly going to get out as soon as possible to see it. And I'm really happy that you hung out with us for a few minutes today.
It's been a blast, you guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Cameron. I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Thanks, Mark.
Take care.
Right, take it easy.
Be continued.
Okay, right on, man.
Take care, you guys.
You know, I wasn't going to tell him that... I didn't see the movie yet, and you know, I told him, but I had to tell him. I had to be honest.
You had to be honest.
You know, you got to be honest sometimes. In just a couple minutes, we're gonna come back. Why do I keep saying come back? You know, because I was told that that's a no-no, Riley. You realize that, don't you?
Yeah, I know. It's hard to say. I mean, I see it done all the time in media, so I don't know how big of a no-no it is.
Lock the gates.
That was genius. You know, and I was glad that he was able to appreciate just how important I was to that film. Am I tooting my own horn too much? We got the War on Brains in just a couple minutes. 45 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Lock the gates!
Hi, this is Lawton Smalls, Morning Sedition's Planet Bush Bureau Chief. You know why I'm praying for you? Because you're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Forty-nine past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
I will be at the Osher Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California, this Saturday night at 8 p.m. Come on down for tickets. You can go to marinjcc.org. In a few minutes, we'll be getting into all the latest on the leak case, the plain name leak case. Who's going to get indicted? There's rumors out there that Dick Cheney may resign. That's a rumor, unsubstantiated rumor, but I like it. Every week, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the 4-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, birthplace of Jesus Christ. Yeah. Leader of the Industrial Revolution and founder of Bethlehem Steel Corporation. Producer of the world's first all-steel crucifix.
Yeah.
Saints preserve us, Mark, for in this sacred citadel where the holiest of men once walked, an abomination even worse than the first four books of the Old Testament took place. This week, a biochemistry professor at the esteemed Lehigh University testified in court against evolution and in favor of intelligent design.
Yeah, hey, excuse me, Jim. I hate to make you break character, but aren't you looking for a one-bedroom apartment, preferably in the Park Slope area? No fees?
Mark, this is a bit unorthodox, but yes, I am. Think I can continue now, maybe?
Yeah, sure. But first, you want to hear some funny stories about my cats?
No. The angels of science are looking down upon us. And like the days of old, the forces of nonsensical babble, laughable superstition, and weird holy men lead this nation's injured body of rational thinking out onto an ice floe. And
Hey, Jim? Mark Riley here. You know, the brother. What's your price range?
Oh, around, you know, $1,700. I'm being hopeful.
And I bet you can be reached by email at jearl@airamericaradio.com.
Yeah, I suppose so. Can I go on?
Yeah, go ahead.
This landmark federal trial may decide whether intelligent design can be taught in public school science classes and as an alternative to a little something called reality. Shameful.
Hey, Jim. Sorry to bother you, buddy, but
huh?
It's Chris. Me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the free gum guy.
Yeah. I heard you need that apartment by November 24th. Is that correct?
Yeah, Chris, but that really doesn't have anything to do with what I'm talking about here. You know, you don't have a comment about evolution or the issue of teaching intelligent design in school?
Intelligent what? Dude, I'm the free gum guy. Free gum?
Ignominious. Yes, billions of tax dollars spent to violate the Constitution.
Jim, hey, it's me, senior producer, Dan Pashman.
What do you want, Dan?
Nothing. I just wanted to say the words senior producer Dan Pashman. Man, I love that.
Hey, Dan, you want to hear some stories about my cats?
Hey, Mark, you want to hear me say senior producer Dan Pashman?
Free gum.
Shut up, all of you, shut up.
To teach mindless, superstitious poppycock to impressionable children, these are the ingredients of the Bush educational agenda. His Xana...
Dude.
What?
This is Goliath, the big intern dude guy. Hey, I heard you're looking for an apartment in junk, and dude, like, I got some good news for you, man. Are you ready?
Yeah, why? Well, of course I am. You found me an apartment?
Oh, man, wow. Where am I? You got some pot?
Xanadu! Well, there's my argument. Boring cat stories, giving out my personal email on radio, Dan Pashman, senior producer, free gum, and a freak named Goliath. If this is intelligent design, then somebody should sack the engineering department. And yes, I do need an apartment. No freaks, please. And that's today's dispatch from...
The War on Rains.
Yeah!
That's Jay Earl at AirAmericaRadio.com.
How fun. How fun of you to involve us all in your sketch.
Yeah, man.
And then hurt us at the end, you bastard. Right? That was just one big setup to saying we're all a bunch of dummies. I get it.
Yeah.
Wow, good for you, Jim.
What are we, unintelligent design?
Yeah. Maybe you should
smart guy.
Maybe you should work for that apartment in California, Jim.
Yeah, how about that? How about Encino? How did that work for you?
There has to be a lesson to everything. That's the important thing.
You want to hear a story about my cat?
Sure. All I learned is that I'm the senior producer.
Yeah, you hang on to that.
Park Slope, huh? That's Park Slope, yeah.
Okay. Oh, man, that was so fun. Everybody's all involved in that. So, you know, if you come out to where I live, Jimmy.
Astoria.
Yeah, what happened with that thing in Park Slope? Anything?
They went with the first guy that applied.
Why? What did that guy have that you didn't? No bitterness?
He was just the first. Well, I guess
he ate meat.
He didn't have all that baggage that I do. Thanks for bringing that up, Mark. You know, Mr. Samsonite.
Oh, yeah. Say, wait, how did that unfold? You were like, I'd really like to be in this apartment. And he was looking at your little resume, and he said, gee, you work on The Daily Show, didn't you? And you're like, no. Don't bring that up.
Yeah, I can't bring that up because of, you know, the suit.
I know. Well, here's a great thing. If you move to Astoria, though you don't eat fish, I'm sure Heather does, right?
Yeah.
You could go right across the street to Marino's and Sons, where they'll hook you up with some monkfish. And
really?
It's, yeah.
What do your cats think of that place?
Oh, you know what? I feed my cats those little...
What happened? Where am I?
You know those little fish? You ever seen... what are they called, those little teeny fish?
Sardines?
Little teeny fish?
No, they're just anchovies. They're smaller than anchovies. They're little teeny ones, and I bring them home to the cats, and they eat them, and the cutest thing, Jim, is
dude,
that...
Dude, Goliath, you got some pot?
No, wait, let me finish, Jim. The cutest thing is that when they eat the little fish, they'll all sit there and they'll have a little tail hanging out of their mouth like a cartoon cat.
Oh, nice.
No!
Do they pull the little fish out and just all the bones are left?
Yes, Dan, they do that as well, you dummy senior producer.
Senior producer.
How about this Cheney guy, though?
Is
he going to resign or what?
I hope so. Good for you for getting in the mix like that.
He's dealing with pressing world issues.
You know, it's 39 past the hour.
Yeah, it is. No, it's not. You looked at the wrong number. Oh, see, that's why you can only do characters. Yeah. It's actually coming up on 57 past the hour. You know, you just freaked a lot of people out.
Yeah, you sure did.
They were like, I get to go back to sweep, and they might miss work because of you if they stop
listening.
Nothing
wrong with keeping people on their toes, Mark.
That's right. I agree with you, Jim. This has been, speaking of keeping people on their toes, Tropical Storm Wilma officially became a Category 5 hurricane. This is no joke, Jim. You know, you're lucky you're not looking for real estate in Florida because it's going to get windy there this weekend. Hopefully it doesn't hit too horribly, but do prepare yourselves down there. Don't mean to be a buzzkill for the little party we were having here, but it is important that you know that it is over Central America now. It's over Mexico now. It may be heading to Florida this weekend, so prepare yourself, Mom. That's all I'm saying, all right? Bring the cats in. Tell John to relax and board up the windows or whatever the hell you do down there. And, Jim, good luck with your apartment search.
Thanks a lot.
In California. 57 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition. On Air America Radio.
It's 6 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. It's Wednesday. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey!
For those of you who live in the Bay Area, just another shout-out. This is only 3 this morning, my friends. I will be at the Osher Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California, Saturday night at 8 p.m. For tickets, go to marinjcc.org. Onward into the big business, Riley. In a few minutes, we'll have Slander Minute. Also, we're going to answer the question, perhaps, are Jews smarter? That's right. All you anti-Semites, it might be true, everything you say about us, that we are smarter and that we do run everything. We'll find out. We're going to talk to somebody who wrote the cover story for New York Magazine this week. But let's get into the plane leakage case. All of you know what it is. We can't explain it every day because it'll take way too long. But some people are in trouble. The vice president might be resigning. The vice president might be indicted. Who knows? That's big trouble. But there's a lot of other information about that that's coming out. But I do want to tell you that most of the Republican talking points, or should I say right-wing talking points that comes out of the dirty media orifices of the right-wing propaganda machine, is basically calling the leak case the criminalization of politics, the, quote, criminalization of politics. In other words, they are basically saying that outing an undercover CIA agent and compromising national security in a time of war with an act of treason and anti-Americanism is just politics. If you buy this, you are truly lost and are un-American in your beliefs yourself. There are laws for a reason. If these laws were acting in the name of national security, if these guys were acting in the name of national security, why would they have compromised the cover of a CIA agent on the weapons of mass destruction beat to punish someone who disagreed with them and prove them wrong because they don't care about national security? And of course, according to a database search, every, and I mean every television reference to the CIA leak case as a criminalization of politics in the last 30 days plopped like turds in the living rooms of the hate zombies care of Fox News. And it was introduced into the segment every time at the dirty sphincter-like mouths of Fox News anchor people.
That's right. Guests never mentioned it. It's the Anchors. It's the O'Reillys, the Hannitys, the Wallaces, the Varneys, Bill Kristol. These are the people that are bringing up this whole notion that this is criminalization of politics. And you'll notice that they're kind of using the same frame with Tom DeLay. Oh, this is just politics. Oh, this is just what we do. Well, no, this isn't just what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be doing the business of the American people, not the business of enriching yourself.
Now, Roger Ailes is still the dude at Fox, right? Is he the big man?
I think he may well be the head honcho.
And he's a Republican operative. He's been one for years. I mean, this is so clearly a dissemination of talking points, as usual, on Fox News. But the idea that is a criminalization of politics at hand, the idea that this country, both on a corporate level and on an individual level, can make exceptions like this in their minds is ludicrous. This is the kind of thing that leads to people dying for the wrong reasons. It's the kind of thing that leads to CEOs pillaging their company's treasuries and same with the country pillaging of their corporations' treasuries and lying about it, cooking the books. It's a climate of denial and rationalization that is criminal. That it's not the politics that are criminal. It is the ability to rationalize by calling it a criminalization of politics that is criminal.
Well, yeah, and this grand jury is not looking into all this for laughs. And the more we read with each passing day, the more we are learning about how deep the deception that led us into this war has actually been, because the plane situation is just an offshoot of that. It's the offshoot of the original lies and garbage that were constructed by a group of people working inside our government to convince the American people that this war was the right thing to do.
Right. And let's talk about that. Let's talk more specifically before we get into the nuances of the case, if we're going to do that actually right now. But let's talk about, I like this thing, about the difference between Valerie Wilson, Joe Wilson's wife, and Valerie Plame, which is how she went as a covert operative in the case, Riley.
Well, yeah, because the name Valerie Wilson would not have set off alarm bells in foreign intelligence offices, because she was not known as that. She was known as an employee of an organization that was a CIA front. Now, okay. The name Valerie Plame, on the other hand, set off alarm bells all over the world, because these foreign intelligence offices now are looking at themselves and saying, wait a minute, have our people been dealing with this person? Now we know that the company she's working for is a CIA front and was likely spying on us. Let's find out exactly what she was doing, who she came in contact with, and if she came in contact with any foreign intelligence officers, their lives might be jeopardized, or American deep cover intelligence officers in those same countries might find their lives being jeopardized.
So you see, so whoever was part of this leaking of her name, of Valerie Plame's name, whoever was part of that, compromised national security on a global scale. And in that way, in the way that it was compromised, because of her, it's not just about the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. It really becomes an issue of treason and espionage. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And think about this for a moment.
Yeah.
Anytime someone, for example, in Iraq is kidnapped,
yeah,
or someone is taken hostage, mm-hmm, what's the first thing they're accused of being?
Spy.
Bingo. Spy. Right. Now, imagine what it's like if you really are one.
Well, this is a profound thing, because if you have the right saying that this is just a politicization of politics, or a criminalization of politics, that they are rationalizing something that is as anti-American as it gets, which is treason, which the vice president may be guilty of instigating and should be probably publicly executed for it, if that's possible, but I doubt that that's what they're going to do. It's probably going to be a conspiracy charge, and this country doesn't publicly execute its presidents or vice presidents. But I'm not necessarily calling for that, but
you afraid of getting sued?
No, I'm not afraid of getting sued. I'm not afraid of anything. It's a freedom of speech. It's
there
a free
you go.
Country.
First you Amendment, it. Damn it.
There ain't no law against saying that kind of stuff. I hate to tell you, there just isn't. But let's get into who is singing to the grand jury, because it is somebody who was close to Dick Cheney. It is somebody who was in Dick Cheney's office. It was his Middle East point man, John Hanna, who he was, moonlighting in Cheney's office, because John Bolton let him out of his deal.
Oh, Well, yeah, and that, again, this is where there's a problem for these people, because John Bolton, before he got to the UN, was dealing with nuclear proliferation, the same street that Valerie Plame was working as an undercover CIA operative. Want to bet that Bolton knew exactly who she was and what she was doing?
Well, of course. I mean, the thing about this stuff, Riley, is politics in and of themselves, the business of politics, is a grand conspiracy. It just is. There are intermeshings of agencies. There are intermeshings of cabals of people that are doing secret things. A lot of them are designed so other people who are connected with them don't know what they're doing specifically as to protect those people, that they insulate these people. And well, now all that insulation is breaking down. So there's really the amount of people that could be connected to this is profound. But just the amount of bit players and big players that we know of, people like Mary Matlin, Condoleezza Rice, perhaps, but doubtful, Karl Rove, definitely, Scooter Libby, definitely, Stephen Hadley, definitely, who worked for Condoleezza Rice.
Well, yes. Yeah, and Condoleezza Rice is going on the Hill today, you know.
Okay.
She's going to be speaking, I believe, before a Senate committee about Iraq.
Well, no one is outside of the net of this thing, and now the general, the prosecutor, the federal prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, is not going to issue a report, which means that he is most likely going for indictments. He's got thousands of papers, thousands of pages of testimony to go through. We don't know how high it's going to go up. But as I said, there are rumors that Cheney may resign. There are rumors that Cheney is going to be nailed on this. We don't even know what the charges are. They could be espionage. They could be criminal conspiracy. It's hard to know right now. It's exciting, though. And I'd like to read this email because I was... You know, I was feeling a little bad about feeling so much glee and joy at the possibility of these guys going down. I said I was experiencing some schadenfreude, and I got an email from a guy. Said, "Good morning, Mark Maron. Your feelings of your use of the German expression of schadenfreude, duh," which I was told is there's a duh at the end by someone who was like, "Wait, it's not pronounced." All right, so should not be considered taking pleasure in the Republican corporate plutocrat's misfortune, but are more simply explained as your sophisticated appreciation of poetic justice. Y'all keep on bringing it on and on and on. We need you on Air America. He's an XM listener down in Alabama.
All right.
This is David down in Alabama listening to us on XM with some words of support. Poetic justice, David, and hopefully... real legal justice. We're going to talk about whether or not intelligent design, you know, the idea of intelligent design as an alternative to evolution. I guess if you say the intelligent designer was working in a big invisible lab making up his, maybe that's it. All right, 16 past the hour. We're going to get into that in a second. Stay with us. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You know, whoever with his phone system can themselves in the mouth and eat their own waste. You know, that's what I say. So leave me alone. I'm trying to get a good take and replay it back on my touch tone pad. So can I play and get a good recording so I can hear how it sounds? I got an inconsistent mental disposition.
Next message.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty-one past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. It's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Saddam Hussein's trial has been adjourned till November 28th. Stay tuned for that. And stay tuned for Mark Green, ladies and gentlemen. Mark Green will be here later. Former candidate for mayor of New York, Mark Green. As we know, New York Times reporter Judah, and by the way, are Jews smarter? Are they? I think they might be. That, according to a study.
Jews.
Free gum, free gum, free gum, free gum. I used to love the fat guys.
Listen, we know. Jew go on.
Oh, damn. You know, New York Times reporter Judith Miller said the vice president's chief of staff helped expose Valerie Plame as a CIA agent. Now people are debating whether Miller is a hero for going to jail to protect a source or a shill for repeating White House falsehoods about Iraq. It's a good story, but we thought we could improve on it. Maybe tweak it a little on today's Morning Sedition Slander Minute. And here's our slander correspondent, Ted Fields. Ted, what can you add to this story?
Well, Mark, I have it on deep background that Judith...
Hey, but by the way, before we get going... Last time you were here, were you on crack?
Mark, that is slander. I will not tolerate slander. I can sue you for slander. Now can I talk about Judith Miller?
Yeah, sure.
Judith Miller killed Alexander Hamilton in a famous duel in Weehawken, New Jersey in 1804.
All right.
She lived abroad from 1808 to 1812 and spent her declining later years as a moderately successful attorney.
Ted, that's not even good slander. No one's going to believe Judith Miller killed Alexander Hamilton or that she lived in the early 19th century.
You're damaging my self-esteem, Mark. That's abuse.
All right, okay, I'm sorry.
Everybody around here is abusive to me. Cardinal Milfington, Bruce Cherry, Barry Lank, Lawton Smoke.
Wait, whoa, Barry Lank? Wait a minute. You, the character Ted Fields, resent the staff member who plays you?
He touched me in a bad place this morning.
Ted.
Oh, come on. Don't you despise some of the people around here? Don't you hate Mark Maron?
Hey, wait. I am Mark Maron.
Not you. The guy who plays you.
Oh. I do kind of hate him.
Me too.
What? Shut up, Riley.
Guys, we have a problem.
What? That's Kaylor, our engineer in the booth. What's the problem, Chris?
Our senior producer, Dan Pashman, he just broke character.
Dans une fête à faire sauter les plaques d'aiguë.
Wow. The guy who plays Dan Pashman is French?
I can't even follow this sketch anymore. Let me read that again. I can't even follow this sketch anymore.
You read it better the first time.
No one's paying attention to me.
I'm sorry, Ted. You're right. This is your report. Do you have anything to add about Judith Miller?
I have it on good authority that Judith Miller, the controversial reporter from the New York Times... I'm missing a page in my script.
Please leave.
Come on!
Just leave. No, just leave.
Nobody does this to Matt Drudge.
This has been the Morning Sedition Slander Minute with our slander correspondent, Ted Fields. You know, someone should do it to Matt Drudge.
I'm tired.
Get out of here, Barry.
Okay. Oh, wow.
I don't even know what just happened.
Wow. You know,
does anyone know what just happened? It's like, it's what is this, Meta Wednesday? All right, here we go. It's like, wow, here we go. What do we got now? Lehigh University professor Michael, how do you pronounce that name? Behe or Bay?
Behe?
I like Behe. It can't be that, though, can it? It's got to be Bay or some B-E-H-E.
Bay-hey?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I made a note to myself before show. Find out how you pronounce B-E-H-E. I'm going to say Behe. Whatever his name is. He's an advocate of intelligent design and the author of a book about it. He testified for the defense in the case of Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District on Monday. This is the case where 11 parents of Dover school students, this is in Pennsylvania, sued the district and school board over a requirement that ninth grade biology students be informed of intelligent design as a scientific alternative to evolution, my friends. The plaintiff are arguing that intelligent design isn't really creationism in disguise, that's crossing the separation of church and state, essential to our democracy, but in a smaller way, essential that the children not be intentionally retarded by religious fanaticism in science class. All right, this professor claims that intelligent design doesn't dismiss the theory of evolution, but sees it as incomplete and flawed because the mechanisms of life it doesn't explain in terms of how things are propelled to work together, you know, which means that intelligent design, he's basically saying that because things are so complicated on a molecular level, that intelligent design must have made the machines.
And well, you know what's funny about this guy? He's doing a baby step sort of thing here. What he's saying is that this is a intelligent design is a scientific theory, and there doesn't have to, the intelligent force does not have to be a god, though he believes it is. So what he's doing is trying to leave a little bit of wiggle room here, and by saying that it doesn't have to compete with evolution, although that's what they're doing with this school board.
But dude, it's like what he's doing is he's exploiting a loophole where science could certainly fill it with something that isn't science. I mean, evolution is a fact. There are other explanations unfolding through real scientific research of the same crap he's trying to push off as intelligent design. This is a struggle between surrendering scientific inquiry to faith in a myth as opposed to instigating true scientific curiosity in young people. This is creationism being taught in biology class.
This is the same scenario that the religious right is using with regard to abortion. Chop away at it with baby steps.
insert intelligent design in small baby steps. Yeah, that's the whole gaps theory.
I get it, but it still doesn't make sense. It's
of course
like,
it
hey,
doesn't
it,
make
it,
sense.
It can't be explained. It must be God. It must be a Martian did it.
Somebody.
I mean, you know, it's like, why not just let science do its job? Hey, you know what? If he were a Jew, he might be smarter than this. And we'll find out why. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Jews.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Hold on to your seats because Mark Green's coming. That's right, Mark Green, Democratic candidate for New York Attorney General, is going to be here in the studio. And just the countdown starts now. I'm sorry, man. That's you know.
He's going to explain it all to us.
Yeah, very slowly. Here we go. Our next guest recently examined a controversial new study that's adamant in its finding that Jews, thanks in large part to evolution driven by discrimination, are just plain smarter than everyone else. Something I've always thought. Anyways, she writes about the study in the cover story of the current issue of New York Magazine called Are Jews Smarter? She's a contributing editor with New York Magazine. She joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Jennifer Senior. How have you been?
I have been fine. And, you know, in lame defense, Mark Green's a nice guy.
How you doing, Jennifer?
I'm fine. How are you?
We like Mark Green.
Mark Green.
He's a nice guy. What we're trying to do is propel him into his segment with a powerful introduction.
Yes, it was like he was yanked from a slingshot.
Exactly. And we're going to see how he reacts to that. So now, how much credence? Well, first of all, explain the report to us. Who did this report that proves that Jews are smarter?
Sure. Yeah, they don't prove it. And let me just start by saying that, I mean, one of the reasons that we ran this and we're intrigued by it is that the report got a free pass as soon as it was sort of posted on the internet. You know, the New York Times and The Economist and a bunch of other publications treated it, you know, very seriously, and I was more intent on aggressively debunking it. The two guys who did it, one of them's pretty smart. He's a population geneticist at the University of Utah. He's from the National Academy of Sciences.
Jew? Is he a Jew?
I'm sorry?
Is he a Jew?
No, neither of them are.
Well, that's suspect.
So, and this guy, his name is Henry Harpending. Lovely guy when I spoke to him on the phone. You know, seems to obviously delight in being politically incorrect. The other guy is a guy named Gregory Cochran, and he is sort of an independent agent. And he actually has really, I mean, if you read his independent stuff and not this particular thing that was published, he seems to have this belief that, like, Jews are the smart mice of history, and that if you can figure out what makes these crazy Jews smarter than everybody else, then, and put it in a bottle, then maybe the general population can be smarter too. And that was sort of where I started, was thinking, you know, man, one of these guys has an agenda.
Are they creepy? So there's an agenda there, but what is it? Are they Judeophiles? Is that what you say? Or are they actually planting the seeds of our end?
Yeah. One of the points I make in the piece is that Philo-Semitism and anti-Semitism are uncomfortably close, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, if you're going to single out a group for its putative superiority, it wouldn't be long before somebody can say, you know, that they're also, you know, that there are immutable ways that a group is terrible too. So you want to be careful saying that anything like inheres in a group's genes. That's a very you know, you want to be extremely cautious before you go out on that
list. So that's what they said? It was in our genes?
Yeah. I mean, okay, so to explain the mechanism, what they say, basically, is that the diseases that Jews have that are, you know, that are the most common to Jews, like Tay-Sachs, Niemann-Pick, Gaucher, they're all ones that have to do
with eating
the
issues
that are involved in the story in our nerve cells. That it's actually a mutation, that it's actually these genes, if you carry a gene for any of these diseases, you are more apt to be a smarty.
How's that?
Yes, that's their theory.
How is that, though? If you have a disease gene, how would you be more smart?
I'm sorry?
If you have a disease gene, how
no,
would you...
No, it's not if you have the disease. It's if you carry the gene for the disease. And that's one of the weaknesses in their theory, of course, because actually two copies of this gene makes you sick and die, and you know, and you die usually.
That's not smart.
No, it's not. And in some cases, it actually causes retardation. However, they liken it to how one gene in an African-American that deforms hemoglobin actually protects them from malaria, whereas two causes sickle cell anemia.
Oh, right.
So it's kind of the same theory behind it. If you have one of these genes and you're Jewish, it makes you a little bit smarter, and if you have two, bad things happen.
Makes you sick.
But now, Jennifer, don't they kind of parse this out even among different elements Jewish nomenclature, the Sephardim versus the Ashkenazim,
they
and that
do.
Sort of thing?
Yes, yes. Good. And they say it's in the Ashkenazim, and their reasoning is this, that the Ashkenazim had a different, this is where the selection part comes in also, or the persecution part, rather, that although both groups were obviously persecuted, but the Ashkenazim, they first evolve as a group by settling in, you know, Germany along the Rhine and in northern France, and they are forbidden from doing so many things. They can't farm, they can't do any physical labor, or not a whole lot of physical labor, because they are barred from guilds, that they are forced to do professions that rely on their brains. And the one very obvious profession was lending money, because there were Christian usury laws that prevented
right.
Gentiles from doing this. So the only way you could survive, virtually the only way really, is if you were savvy enough to actually do something that required a cognitive talent. So, you know, that meant lending money. And that meant if you could do that, then you prospered. You had lots and lots of kids, and therefore you continued. And so therein, to their minds, began, you know, kind of like, that was the beginning of smart Jews, or Jews being selected for their smart.
Well, what about, let me just tell the people who you are. Jennifer Senior is a contributing editor for New York Magazine. We're talking about her cover story, Are Jews Smarter? Well, I'm not a math guy, and I'm no dummy. What about the singing Jews, or the funny Jews?
Right, or like the guys like Lenny Bruce.
Exactly.
Right, really well. Yeah, see, this is the problem with a theory like this. Most geneticists who are at all self-respecting will tell you that, I mean, it's hard enough to isolate genetically what causes eye color. You know, it's not what we all learned in high school with a big B and a little B. It's even more complicated than that.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're going to talk about something as immensely complicated and multi-determined as intelligence, I mean, how do you isolate a gene for that? I mean, you know, there are, like, a million kinds of depression. There are a million kinds of drinkers. There are a million kinds of shyness. How on earth do you account for intelligence? It's not like there's like some gene sitting at the end of some chromosome somewhere going, oh, this is the thing that makes you smart.
I always thought that it was Jewish mothers saying you're not good enough.
Well, you know, that is in fact a viable and time-honored theory, and one that actually, if you talk to enough geneticists, they'll probably say they're more likely to agree.
Jennifer, I got a question here, because, you know, there's been some scientific research that says that there are some people in Israel who are Jews who share identical DNA with some South Africans. How would this study explain that?
Yeah, it wouldn't. I mean, the answer is it wouldn't. I mean, unless the argument... Well, I mean, first of all, there are many kinds of Jews in Israel. You know, that right, there are Sephardim, there are Ashkenazim. You know, it's interesting about the South... I mean, the South Africans were actually, I guess, theoretically part of the Ashkenazim, because, I mean, they came over... You know, that was another migration pattern, right?
Yeah, and there is a group in South Africa called the Lemba, who insist that they're Jews.
Oh, very old. Sorry, you're talking about... Yeah. That predates all of this stuff.
Yeah, those are the ones that claim to be the descendants of the priests, right?
No, right. I mean, here's the problem. I mean, it's not like we have great records.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, there wasn't a lot of paper. There wasn't a lot that survived. Yes, and I mean, how you define a Jew, how you define a Semite, for that matter.
Yeah.
Or, you know, exactly, if you want to tell, like, what's an Irish person? What's a Mexican? You know, I mean, if you want to tell me genetically what a Mexican is, I'd be really curious.
I could probably, it's weird because that gets into stereotypes, and you can see how this information could prove to be dangerous. Now, what in terms of you investigating this story, what do you think the doctor's intentions were in doing this?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, as I said, one of them just seems to have a very kind of clear agenda. That if you read his independent kind of internet postings, he seems really really preoccupied with the enhancement of intelligence. And so there is a part of him that seems very intrigued by Jewish intelligence and thinks that if you look at it, you know, and you put it in a bottle somehow, you figure out what the actual genetic or biological mechanisms are, you know, then you can peddle it to a drug company and patent it and do quite well. And I guess he believes in some ways that it would be beneficial to the human race. I mean, he didn't sound to me like, you know, like Mingala or something.
Right, he wanted to put it in a bottle, not an oven.
Not an oven.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, Jennifer, how do these guys explain the Asians? I mean, you know, the general perception is the Asians are the smart ones in this country.
Well, this is actually possibly my favorite quote from my story is when Ed Koch says, "Really? I always thought that the Asians were the smart ones." and this is the problem. I mean, generally what seems to happen is that it's any one immigrant group, right, that's aggressively striving to assimilate, values learning, you know, chose to be in a particular country because they wanted to actually do well. And that is precisely what you are seeing. Asians are now just over 50%, I want to say, of Stuyvesant High School and just under at Bronx Science. Either that or it's the other way around. It's 53% and 49%. You know, that's pretty high. I think your point is well taken. That is precisely, you know, that's part of the very big body of evidence that sits on the nurture side of the ledger.
Yeah, and also, as you know, Jennifer Senior, that there is a movement in this country on behalf of the radical Christians who actually want to retard the youth of the country by teaching them mystical things as opposed to science.
Are we talking about intelligence?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Am I supposed to judge?
Well, that explains it. That explains why Jews are smarter. Intelligent design.
Yeah.
It is very well branded, that word. I have to admit, the name, whoever came up with that name is quite...
Well, if there is an intelligent designer, we are the chosen people. It works on all levels.
If you'd like to talk to any of them about that, I'm sure Dobson would love to talk with you about that on a show.
We got to call Richard Dobson. Well, look, Jennifer, it was great talking to you again.
Yep. You too.
And, if you want to see her piece, it's Are Jews Smarter? It's in the October 24th issue of New York Magazine. Have a good day.
Hey, thanks. You too.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye. So that's something that we always heard when I was a kid. You know, there was something, I remember when I worked in a deli. I was working in a deli in Boston. And for some reason, someone pointed out a Jewish mobster to me, and I had not learned about Bugsy Siegel or the history of Jewish mobsters. And in my head, I was like, really? A Jewish mobster? That's ridiculous. Jews don't do that. But oddly, they do, and they were good at it. And Meyer Lansky was one of the great bean counters for the mob and the developer of the mob, and to the point where Israel turned him away when he wanted to retire. So that didn't work out for him. So that's where Jewish intelligence did not work for Meyer Lansky. I'm rambling. What do you say?
Listen, the Jew go on.
Very well used.
Frigom. I used to love the fat guys.
See, that's all I got of you. All right. You know, we're going to do the Cliff Notes in just a second, and Mark Green's coming up. Mark Green, take it easy. So what? Babbling, 46 past the hour.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend, Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley, in conjunction with Air America Radio Productions, is pleased to present the following guest. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, fasten your seatbelts and prepare yourselves to be rocked, rocked, rocked! Now entering the studio is the man who joins us each and every Wednesday! 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 He crushed more cars than Truckosaurus and Bigfoot combined!
That's kind of in a proverbial sense, not meant to be taken, well, you know.
When he was New York City public advocate!
Advocate!
He's the co-author of the book on Bush, How George W. Misleads America, and a Democratic candidate for New York State Attorney General!
General!
General! Make some noise for the monster of Midtown, the Goliath of Gotham, Mark Green!
Oh. There you go, Mark.
Yeah.
Impossible to follow that. The three Marks have engaged in a mutual smackdown.
There we go. With Mick Foley when
That's
we need
right.
him.
So, Mark, what is happening? Is it do you have anything good to report about Ferrer's campaign? Is that over? What's happening?
Ferrer's behind 24-3 in the fourth quarter. Now, occasionally a team scores four touchdowns in the fourth quarter and wins.
Yeah.
And I've been an underdog who's won, and in my career I've been a favorite who's lost. So,
yeah.
But at the moment, it's all breaking Bloomberg's way, Mayor Bloomberg. And for those of you in the other 49, why are we talking about the New York City race? Well, there are only three races this year with any national impact.
Yep. Wait on us.
Virginia gubernatorial, New Jersey gubernatorial, which are both very close,
mm-hmm.
and New York mayoralty. And this year, though, Bloomberg, Mayor Bloomberg, is A, the incumbent, B, spending $100 million in a city. In 1964, in current dollars, Lyndon Johnson spent less than that winning the presidency in 50 states.
Unbelievable.
So we're talking about someone who'll spend more than $100 a vote. And I commend his restraint that he hasn't given every voter a car, put his name on the side, and said, hey, it's just a piece of literature. So Ferrer is a intelligent, experienced former borough president who's being outgunned in money. And a lot of Democrats, some Democrats, because they like to be with the winner, are switching and endorsing Bloomberg because he's the incumbent with money and a personality sweeter than Giuliani's, which is not that hard.
Okay, well, let's talk about something our national audience can understand. Retribution. Why is it that there's no avenue of retribution in terms of how Democrats deal with Democrats who stray off the ranch, who go and endorse Republicans?
That's a hell of a good question. The answer is that our Democrats are open, liberal. Hillary Clinton put it so well, Mark. Republicans fall in line. Democrats have to fall in love before they support a candidate. And so if someone strays, what are the mechanisms for retribution in the Republican Party where you have bosses? In New York State, it was Senator Al D'Amato in the past. Now it's Governor Pataki. Yeah. Wow. I'm with him every Tuesday night, necessarily so on a TV talk show. So they can withdraw money or punish them. Democrats have never done that. And there may be a way that our Democratic state leader should say any Democrat who doesn't like a nominee can stay neutral. But if you cross the aisle and support a Republican, after we, the Democrats, have nurtured you, gotten you your chairmanship of your legislative branch, gotten you the office you hold, and you betray us, then you can't run as a Democrat next time. I'd like to see Assemblyman Denny Farrell, our state chair, consider such a thing.
So now what do you think in terms of the 2006 midterm elections? Do you think we got a shot at some of these Senate seats? Do you think we have a shot at getting the Congress back? Tell me.
On paper, no, because so fewer congressional seats are competitive. Mark, most people think 30 to 40 seats out of 435, less than 10%, it could go either way. So how do we Democrats make up 15 when only 30 are competitive? In the Senate, there are more Democrats up for re-election in the 06 cycle than Republicans. However, when you look at the polling data now,
yeah,
Democrats, the minority party, are in a stronger position to net seats in 06 in the Senate and House than were Gingrich Republicans even to net seats in 1993. And we now know, of course, that in 94, Gingrich took over. Both chambers went Republican. And so when you look at the country headed in the right direction, Bush's favorability, it's going south. Therefore, in a sense, the numbers indicate we can do it, but the number of available competitive seats indicate we can't.
You mean to tell me this is something ours to lose?
It's really, look, I hate, I'm a Democrat. I love when Democrats win. I'm sorry that Bush has taken the country to hell in a handbasket in terms of the deaths in Iraq, lousy economy, trying to sabotage Social Security, the culture of corruption and cronyism in Washington. We see all the indictments. So he's hurting the country, but that means he's hurting the incumbent party. And when there's an impulse for a change in a two-party system, it's going to swing Democratic big time. And actually, the Virginia and New Jersey gubernatorial races are bellwether barometers to indicate where we may go in 06.
All right, Mark Green. Well, you know, this has been good. It's been informative. It's been nice to see you, and I think you followed the big intro fine.
You sure did.
I've never had an intro like that.
we wanted to give you something special. So thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week. What do we got tomorrow? Cindy Sheehan stopping
Cindy
by.
Cindy Sheehan is coming by live in studio. Maybe she should run for something. What do you think?
We'll ask her.
Yeah. And Marin, it's been fun.
Has been.
Air America Radio.